All right, so two events that seem to have defined and stimulated meta-analysis in psychology. Most other areas piled on afterwards. 1952, Hans Eysenck, who was wanted to change the way psychotherapy was done and thought the way to start was by saying everything we've done up until now sucks. So we should follow my ideas. Every teenager comes up with that idea, and so do many professionals. Reviewed the available literature and concluded there was no favorable effects of psychotherapy. Guess how that went over. 20 additional years of empirical research failed to resolve the debate, just to put it in quotes. That would be today's understatement. 78, Gene statistically aggregated the findings of 375 psychotherapy outcome studies conducted during those 20 years. Glass and Smith concluded that psychotherapy did work. Glass called it meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is an analysis of analyses. Instead of an analysis of data, it's an analysis of analyses. That's the part we have to get used to first, is the nature of a meta-analysis. In a meta-analysis, the case is an effect size. Now, 10 years ago, when I gave this lecture, I would have said, a meta-analysis, the case, is a published research study. But that has changed importantly in several ways. A meta-analysis has as its case some effect size. Those are the people, or the rats, or the cities, or whatever. But that's the case, is an effect size. Glass built on a bunch of things. The earliest version of meta-analysis goes back to 1944. R.A. Fisher was a biologist who did an awful lot of what we think of as ANOVA. He took a statistical model and he gave it to biology, and psychology was standing right there with their hand out. When a number of quite independent studies of significance have been made, it sometimes happens that although few or none can be claimed individually as significant, yet the aggregate gives an impression that the probabilities are on the whole lower than would have been obtained by chance. Now this is 1944. This was before p less than 0.05 became magical. Back then, you cranked out an exact p-value by actually doing the semi-partial deviation, differentiation, and you looked at it and you said, yeah, that's small enough, I think I'm going to reject the null. I'm going to treat this as evidence that we have something that we wouldn't expect by chance alone. So that's why it doesn't say anything about p less than 0.05. It wasn't inculcated yet. So the idea was that you could take p-values. Back then there were no effect sizes. Nobody thought about effect sizes. The only time you got an R is when you calculated a correlation. There was no D. And so this was the idea that maybe we can do something in aggregate. Cochrane, who was the other person who did a lot of what we now think of as ANOVA, figured out a way of aggregating means. So we would aggregate a mean for one group across studies, aggregate a mean for another group across studies, and compare those aggregated means. The magic in both of these bits of math is the sample size that results from aggregating across studies. Because that meta-analysis gets credit for every participant in all of those conditions. So now instead of 20 and 20 or 60 and 60 and 85 and 32, now it's 10,000 and 11,004. As you might imagine, it's easier to reject the null with very large sample sizes. And that was the principal argument. Cochrane laid out much of the statistical foundation of modern meta-analysis, including inverse variance weighting, which is a way of taking sample size into account. Everybody agreed that larger samples are more believable. So larger samples, studies with larger samples, should get more credit or have more of an influence in the meta-analysis. But how are you going to do that? How are you going to weight things? And Cochrane was the one who gave us inverse variance weighting, which has become the principal tool. So we go from, since this is all about p-values, let's get a better p-value by aggregating, to since we're really trying to compare means, let's get a best possible estimate of those means and then compare those, taking the sample sizes that influence the different means into account. When you read a literature review, what you typically see is the literature divided up into three categories. These are the studies that found the effect that we'd like to think is true. Here's the studies that got a null, and here's some of the weirdos that happened to get it backwards. Notice that that is all based on significance testing. We know that significance testing is not what we do best, especially now that we know something about power analysis, and we realize that if you take the typical effect size in a behavioral study and the typical sample size in a behavioral study, we've got pretty much exactly the P of 0.05 risk of a type 1 error that we thought we had, but we have roughly a 60% chance of a type 2 error. So, if only we had some way to take care of this huge risk of type 2 error, which is nothing other than a power problem. And that's what meta-analysis is going to do. Significance testing is not well suited to this task because it's highly dependent on sample size. Most errors are type 2 errors. And there's the question of comparability of studies that are the same study. Meta-analysis changes the focus to the direction and magnitude of the effect. Instead of asking, is there an effect or not? Because if you jack the N up big enough, there's always an effect. Right? The null doesn't actually make sense as a purveyor of truth. If you really measure the entire sample with a good index, the chances that you're going to get the same mean from those two populations is nil. Right? And so chasing null effects, why bother? But what we are going to put our energy into is aggregating the effect size. Because we do want to know whether there's an effect. The reason for knowing whether or not there's an effect is so that we know that that effect size is likely to be zero or not. It's not going to be zero when you jack the N up big enough if you have a big enough collection of studies in your meta-analysis. But the question is size and direction of the effect. Isn't this what we're interested in anyway? The magnitude and the direction represented by the effect size. So the effect size is going to be our chattel in a meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is applied to collections of research that are empirical rather than theoretical. There have been some wonderful attempts within the qualitative research to come up with ways of doing things that are roughly parallel to meta-analyses. It's a little tougher because linguistic aggregation is harder than numeric aggregation, but there's been some good work done. And if you are a qualitative research type, you should check that out. Produces quantitative results rather than qualitative findings. In other words, we're going to have a number that represents what we think is going on in the population. And to quantitative people, that's all we ever wanted. We want a single number summary of what's probably going on. That's effect size. We'd like an estimate of the chance of an error for whatever we decide about that effect. If we think that effect is real and we're going to treat it as real, what's the chance we just made a type 2 error? If we're going to treat that effect size as not real and we're going to treat it as no effect, what's our chance of a type 2 error? So we still want p-values, but we principally want p-values so that we can get to error estimates. Have findings that can be configured in a comparable statistical form. There's three basic kinds of effect sizes that we're going to see: standardized effect sizes, correlations, and odds ratios. Different research areas like different things. We're going to emphasize the correlation because, as I'll show you, we can turn almost anything into a legitimate correlation. That allows us to aggregate the largest number of studies. So whether you were using correlations, chi-squares, or ANOVAs in the study, we can aggregate all of that. Examine constructs and relationships that are comparable given the question at hand. This is going to be really important. I want to say this a couple of different times. The old meta-analyses had the question and the challenge of what studies to include because those studies are comparable. Modern meta-analyses grab everything they possibly can and ask the question, what does and doesn't produce comparable results? And when we look at the research loop again here in a little bit, remember that was the whole idea. Once you run the study, then you run the replications to see if you can get the same result whenever you want when you run the same study. Then you start with the programmatic operational research to see what variations change the results. So since you're intentionally varying things, intentionally trying to change the results or see what does change the results, wouldn't it be nice if we had a statistical technique that allowed us to back that up? Where we could say, well, these are the studies that ran it within group, these are the studies that ran it between group. Look, it matters. These are the studies that had these confounds, these are studies that had different confounds. Oh, it doesn't matter. We get about the same effect size no matter what the confounds are. We need something that allows us to do more than just say, there's my one effect size aggregated across all these studies. If that effect size has variability across studies, we need to know what attributes of the study lead to differences in effect size. And that's the same thing we've been saying since the first time we put the research loop up on the board in August. There's different kinds of research amenable to meta-analyses. There's a couple of these that are really common. There's a couple I want to emphasize. Central tendency research. This gets overlooked. Remember how we talked about, a statement like 53% of females in the world, or 50% of people in the world are females? Where the hell's that come from? I don't remember them asking me. Because we don't ever collect population data. So how does a descriptive statistic get elevated to a population parameter? One very reasonable way of doing that is a meta-analysis. And that's what some people did. It turns out that about 62% of people in skin cancer research are females. How the hell did they do that? They pulled up 18,400 and some studies that weren't looking at males and females and anything else. And no matter what they were studying in dermatological cancer, they grabbed the proportion of females, put that and did a meta-analysis on that percentage. Make sense? There's all kinds of central tendency research meta-analysis that would be better than us saying, it's probably about 30%. The data's there. Do the analyses. Between groups contrasts and within groups contrasts are by far the most common. One of the problems is that meta-analyses were designed when nearly all research was between groups analyses. Within groups analyses have some challenges. Within group studies tend to produce larger effect sizes than between groups analyses, part of which seems to be representative, and part of which seems to be statistical bias. We got to sort that out when we get to it. Studies of statistical association between variables. This is when people are looking at correlations. It's sometimes called individual differences analysis instead of groups comparison analysis. It's the other half of the world. But it also includes measurement research, psychometric, egeometric, econometric research, where sometimes what you're doing the meta-analysis on is the reliability or the validity index of a study. More and more often, people are asked to do a Cronbach's alpha on the instruments that they're using in their master's and their dissertation, or maybe all of their research. It's become pretty common to go get to collect your data and put it into the database in item form so that you can look at various psychometric statistical summaries. Because of this, we're able to go back into the literature and find everybody who used a particular index and put together a meta-analysis to see in what populations or in what uses or under what conditions is there variability in the reliability or validity of that instrument. Anytime you're going to look at a number and say to yourself, ooh, I like that number, or oh, I don't like that number, you could probably, with some effort, do a meta-analysis to decide whether the number you're looking at is representative or not, to get that represented aggregated meta-analysis, and then decide how you feel about things.